I'm very, very happy now to welcome John Davis. He is a poet, he's a professor at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and his latest book of poetry is called Preliminary Report. It's from Copper Canyon Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Ah, it's great to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So in your poems, and it's always tricky to do radio programs about poetry because anything that you say about it isn't going to be as good as the poem, if it's a good poem, and these are very good poems.
Well, thank you.
But you are dealing with a lot of questions, and as I was reading it, I found that something that came up for me over and over was this ongoing question of how to respond to the world, how to respond as a person of moral courage, as an ordinary person just walking around trying to deal. Is that something that you are concerned with in your writing?
Yeah, that's probably a central concern. And it's more a book of questions than a book of answers, I suppose. And I think that's probably a good place for a poet to be, refining the questions.
Yeah.
I wish I had more answers.
Why don't we start by reading a poem or two?
All right. Yeah, I'd like to start with just a couple of summers ago. I would wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning before it was light, and I'd go out in the this little courtyard and write. And I wrote 20, 30 poems, and I think two are in the book, which is pretty much my percentage. And this is called In Darkness.
Meaning percentage of the ones that you decide not to throw in the trash?
Right, yeah. They float around. I don't have the heart to throw them in the trash, but they sit on various hard drives. And it's not that they're not well-made. There's a lot of well-made poems sitting on my hard drive, but there's a difference. And I always tell my students, oh, I just made that one up, which is different than the ones that you kind of half receive or receive in holy, you know, the whole idea of inspiration.
Yeah.
So you know, you get to a certain point in your life and you can make a poem. You can make a poem that works as a poem, but the other spark isn't always there.
Right.
So for me, the spark was in the couple that made it into the book. And this is called In Darkness. Silence in this suburb of cars and dogs, of roar and rumble, sudden thump at the railroad crossing. But this morning, before 5 a.m., there's only the wash, the waterfall of cars on I-25, which sounds in my ear almost like the sound of blood in my arteries, that inner traffic. In the pre-dawn silence, a bright crescent of moon, darkness visible, the flared edge. Now a dog barks, now a single bird, another, now a car in the distance. Dog, bird farther off this time, just this one moment of silence before the traffic begins, before the full choir of dogs and birds and coyotes flushed with desire as I begin, shaken and shaking now in the lee of, in the wake of, in the grip of what unnameable fierce beauty.
John Davis, from his new book of poetry, Preliminary Report. I noticed that a lot of the poems, although they're not, you wouldn't read this through and say, wow, this is really a Southwestern nature book, but there is that feeling of New Mexico here and there.
Yeah, and it took me a long time to get there. I remember when I first started writing in New Mexico, I kept writing about my original landscape, which is back in Connecticut, which I knew intimately because I had problems with people, and so I spent the first 18 years of my life in the woods every day.
You had problems with people?
Yeah, I was extremely shy, and my solution to that problem was to avoid people and just go into the woods. So I did that for years and years.
Were you writing poetry already at that time?
When I was 11, I read Emerson and Thoreau, and I started going out into the woods and writing these horribly sentimental nature journals, seeing things that weren't quite there, blowing things out of proportion. And that's how I basically started writing. But I'd never thought about being a writer until many years later. I think when I was 19, I started writing journals and songs. And then somewhere after that, I started really writing poems.
So you have some of the Southwestern landscape and feel in the book, but above all, you have that feeling in many of the poems of being grounded in the present moment and then being way off in thought and then coming back.
Right, yeah, more problems with the now. It could be another title of the book.
Yeah,
there's this pursuit of the now, of the moment in the book that occurs over and over again in different poems.
Which is a kind of a Buddhist idea in some ways,
right.
Or a meditative idea.
Yeah, and I'm not good with the now. I'm not an expert on now. I'm an expert on the moment. I tend to, when you meditate, you're supposed to let go of everything, and I tend to hold on to everything. But yeah, intensely interested in like being present in the world, and that comes from growing up in the woods, where the now is easier.
Well, and it always, I mean, being in the now always ends up being about the senses,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
the observations that you are
right.
making about
right.
the sensory world before
right.
you.
Right. Well, and minus the observations, probably if we're doing it well, right? It's almost a unity with what the senses are giving you. And Wallace Stevens' poem, "The Snowman," is the great poem of the now.
Why don't you read another poem?
You have a choice.
How about, do you want to do Horse and Shadow?
Okay, yeah. This is a poem about my daughter, Gracie, who had this horse called Code Man. It was part thoroughbred and part Hanoverian. It's a gorgeous, powerful, athletic horse. And when we went to sell it, we discovered that even though she'd been riding it for 5 years, it was unrideable. This is a poem about an unrideable horse and shadow. Cold the wind that rifts through the west end door, sounding its low moan, grieving the moments passing. And cold the nose of the near black gelding, where he stomps once in the glistening darkness, the gentled night. My 12-year-old daughter, stiff in her jodhpurs and boots, removes one glove and reaches a carrot toward the shadowed head. Good boy, she purrs, good boy. Good boy, who'd bucked and lurched, galloping hell-bent at the corrugated wall, whirling until he'd launched her from the saddle into the dust-dazzled air. Good boy, she says, and he is. Furious teacher, unendurable bliss, because she says he is. Loyal girl, good friend, forgiver, profferer of carrots, wielder of whips, tiny commander in her wafer-thin saddle.
John Davis, from his book Preliminary Report. There's a title, I guess you would call it the title poem, called Preliminary, well, it's longer than just that. It's called, Preliminary, what is it?
Preliminary Report from the Committee on Appropriate Postures for the Suffering.
It's a long poem, but do you want to read maybe a few lines of the beginning of it or talk about it a little bit? Because it's a very interesting poem thematically, and you titled your book after it.
Right, and it's the only... I've received no reviews of this book yet, but there was one article about this particular poem about the use of satire in poetry. And so the poem is basically a preliminary report from this committee that is recommending postures for the suffering and limiting what they can do. They can't hold up children, all these basic rules. And the poem, of course, is really about committees and how often committees perpetuate their existence and don't solve problems, simply manage things. Almost as part of their nature. And I guess it's obvious, but it was fun to put into a poem. And it required a real commitment to being an unsavory character from the beginning to the end, which I enjoyed. I've seen people try to do this in other poems, and they get nervous because they realize, whoa, what am I saying? And they suddenly like break out with some more politically correct information in the middle of the poem.
Right.
So it was a real challenge.
They just can't keep it up. They
right.
can't keep up the persona.
Yeah, it was a real challenge. And it's a challenge to read it. It's a really painful poem because people laugh a little, nervous laughter at parts of it because it is funny at times. But it's really a very dark poem, ultimately.
The last lines are, "Finally, to those who would recommend programs, who would call for funding and action, I must remind you that we have been charged not with eliminating your suffering, but with managing
it." Yeah, which is, the case. When I read at Collected Works for the book launch, I had my computer read this poem in its computer voice.
Really? A voice synthesized reading of that?
Right.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
It seemed appropriate for the committee report.
Now, inevitably, poets end up writing about writing and writing about art, and you do that too to some extent.
Right, especially art. Maybe less about writing. I'm not sure of it, but definitely about art.
Well, there's some poems that are sort of contemplations about language itself here and there.
Right.
There's one poem which I think is called Art and Life. And this is, it looks like a block of prose. It looks like one big long paragraph. And a bunch of your poems do that. Why do you choose to use that form instead of separate lines?
Section two of the book is entirely prose poems, square poems. My students call it the block. And I don't know why other people do it, but I know why I do it. And it's about acceleration and speed and in the drafting of the poem. I want to move very quickly, and I want to accept everything. And with line breaks, I tend to move much more slowly and meditatively. With the prose poems, I'm kind of careering off in different directions.
So it's a process thing.
Right, yeah. So they appear that way. And I usually put them in lines at some point to kind of tighten up the language, just the craft part of it. I tighten up the language that way.
And then you take them out again.
And then I take them out again and look at them again. And finally, the music of the poem has to be the sentence, not the line, because there are no lines. And so I work really hard at the music of the sentence.
Do you want to read or start reading that poem, Art and Life?
I'll read kind of the questions are all set up in the beginning.
Okay, good.
That I don't really answer, although I suggest an answer at the end. Art and Life. What we need, Susan said, shifting in the rattan chair so the entire chair winced, is to live in such a way that we don't need art. She was holding a glass of white wine in her right hand, touching her right wrist lightly with her left fingertips. She was leaning forward out of the porch light that must have been shining into her eyes when she sat up, obliterating the rest of us. So art, someone asked. It must have been James, whose idealism was somehow unshaken by his endless, close reading of Nietzsche. Is a luxury, or worse, its abundance, a measure of our inadequacies? And I'll stop there.
So all these questions, I mean, I'd never thought, I mean, certainly lots of people have been talking ever since I can remember about whether art is a necessity or a luxury, but I'd never heard the concept of art is not necessary when life is well lived and fulfilling.
Right, and I don't know if that's true. It's just a question
so,
I raised. Well, it's a question that gets resolved at the end.
Right.
When someone says, well, it's not going to happen anyway, so we don't have to worry
about
it.
Our lives are never fulfilled.
Right,
so.
Right. So it's an impossibility. We don't have to ponder it. But
in a poem like this, it's a prose poem, and you've got a couple of characters who are sipping wine and going back and forth, and there's other characters mentioned. Is this a work of fiction? Is this something that it's based on something that really happened?
The characters are all invented.
Yeah.
There's no Susan. But there are stories I've heard that are parallel to some of the characters in the poem, but I wanted the total freedom to have them say whatever I wanted them to say. So it is a work of fiction at that level. Yeah.
I've always sort of assume wrongly, almost always wrongly, that when poets write poems that set up actual situations and become kind of little narratives like that, that it's either autobiographical or descriptive of something that they've lived. But, of course, you guys have as much of a right to be fiction writers as fiction writers.
I always want, some stories don't have, when they don't have a poetry section, I'm always curious where they're going to put the, is it going to be a nonfiction or fiction? My works should always be in fiction. Because every poem, at some level, is a persona poem. I've invented the speaker of every poem. And so even poems that deal directly with my life are apt to be inventions on a theme. I remember Robert Pinsky once said in a little group we were sitting around, and he said that it was not okay for poets to invent. And I thought, I'm in trouble. but I write screenplays and I write fiction and dramatic monologues. My first book was almost all dramatic monologues. And when it came out, I thought, oh, you know, I have no problem with this. It's all dramatic monologues. And then when I first got the book, I opened it up and I said, my God, this is an autobiography told through other characters, through masks.
Little did you know.
Right. And it didn't hit me until that point. And then one time I was reading this poem about, well, it began with a phrase from a friend of mine, and it included some of the details of his life. And I thought, this poem's more about him than it is about me. And then I was reading it, and there was this line in the poem about a boy who was playing basketball, and all the other fathers were in the gym, and this boy didn't have a father, which was the case with both me and this friend of mine. And I choked up, and I said, oh, that's about me. And I hadn't realized it until I read it aloud, and that happens a lot. Dana Levin made me read Of the Merely Personal, and I thought, oh, I'm distanced from this poem. It's the story of my life, but I've dealt with it all.
Right.
And I got in the middle of it, and I said, whoa, this is harder than I thought. So a lot of times, I'm doing it at a very kind of craft level. Got to get the right word.
Yeah.
And then when I finally experience the poem the way a reader would, and that's when I read it publicly, suddenly all the emotional subtext, you know, rises.
It's such an interesting statement about the creative process, because you're so involved in, well, it starts with the kind of, as you mentioned earlier, there's often or sometimes a kind of inspiration, and it's almost like there's a reception of something.
Right.
But then you spend a lot of time in craft.
Right.
And rewriting and crafting and all
right.
that. And then at the end, suddenly that inspired thing is whole.
Yeah, and a stranger to me.
Yeah.
In a way, which is the interesting part of it. That these are all strangers to me. I wrote them, but they're strangers to me.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
There's another poem about your daughter, again, that I wondered if you could read. I think it's called Utilitarianism.
Right. Yeah, my daughter has all the best lines in my last two books. And in this one, I kept and I totally recommend this. If you have children, between the ages of 2 and 4, they're going to say the most amazing things. So I, being a poet and knowing I was going to steal all these things, I kept a book, and every time she said something unusual, I'd put it in there. And she loves the book. She, you know, even all the embarrassing things in there, she loves. And so this is one of the things she said, and let's see if I can find this poem. We were out walking in Salisbury, Maryland, and she was 3 years old, and we came upon a robin that had been hit by a car. Well, that's in the poem. And then her response. Utilitarianism for Gracie. Salisbury morning stippled with flowers, azaleas flaring by the door, rhododendrons sporting their red boutonnieres, magnolias like huge pink artichokes, and birdsong, lisping warblers in the linwoods, the flicker's ratcheting call, mockingbird on the chimney, auctioning the moment. I tried to steer her, just 3 years old, past the robin, expert at noticing, she walked straight to it. What happened to his head, she asked. Hit by a car, I said. She looked and looked, put hands on her knees as she leaned in to study the grizzled ruff of feathers, ants climbing the bent beak, diving into the eye sockets. Finally, she straightened. Oh, well, she said. Around us, birdsong brilliant in the blossoming world. All the other birds have their heads.
John Davis is a poet. He's the author of the new book of poetry, Preliminary Report. He's a professor at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and his work is available at Collected Works Bookstore.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. This was fun.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.